for quite a few years now, I've been looking at archaeology, archaeoastronomy, quantum physics, acoustics, mythology, and consciousness studies, and exploring the possibility that a highly advanced civilization once existed on Earth. The level of geometric exactitude, celestial alignment, vibration-sensitive engineering, all demonstrates an awareness of Earth's subtle energetic anatomy, what we might now call planetary bioelectromagnetism. We have the extremely advanced evidence left behind. We have the shattered remains of incredible temples and structures that defy our conventional models. And so why do we so quickly dismiss the indigenous histories when they are also backed up by architectural anomalies that we cannot explain? Deep within the fortified halls of sacred orders and institutions of global influence that have a vested interest in maintaining particular narratives, protecting their flock from disruptive possibilities. The implications of our true history is a powerful arena of human psychology, and the implications of disclosing information that calls into question the very systems and models that we've established to explain not only our worldly existence, but our spiritual existence. So much hangs in the balance for those who are responsible for curating and maintaining a particular status quo, an entrenched belief system. This cup and the technology and techniques presented within it predate modern nanotechnology by 1,600 years. They couldn't replicate it through the processes and the materials used by the ancient Romans. We still had to fake it to make it. There is a real mystery of sudden technological leaps throughout ancient history that continues to confuse and perplex historians, engineers, and philosophers alike. Some of the most mind-blowing and anomalous innovations are attributed to the ancient Greco-Roman world, achievements that often emerged fully formed without any discernible developmental lineage, from the enigmatic Antikythera mechanism to the persistent legends of Greek fire and the curious resilience and nanotechnological signatures of self-healing Roman concrete. The available evidence hints at a source of knowledge far older than the classical civilizations themselves. When these anomalies are viewed through the lens of conquest-based knowledge acquisition, cross-cultural synthesis, and the suppression of ancient wisdom during the rise of monotheistic religions represented through powerful institutions of Christianity, Judaism, Islam, and of course the rise of the Holy See, the Roman Catholic Church, and the Vatican's position as a nexus of global theological influence, a provocative theory begins to form that the elites of Greece and Rome had the opportunity to be curators of a much older legacy, one of a lost and destroyed civilization long before their time, the secrets of which now lie buried, not just beneath the sands and soils of ancient ruins or at the bottom of our oceans, but deep within the fortified halls of sacred orders and institutions of global influence that have a vested interest in maintaining particular narratives, protecting their flock from disruptive possibilities. The implications of our true history is a powerful arena of human psychology, and the implications of disclosing information that calls into question the very systems and models that we've established to explain not only our worldly existence, but our spiritual existence. So much hangs in the balance for those who are responsible for curating and maintaining a particular status quo, an entrenched belief system, around which all of the edifices of modern society have arisen from and are in turn threatened by unstable foundations if pulled too abruptly. Much could be risked by allowing us, the masses, to have access to knowledge currently reserved for the privileged few. One of the most well-known, researched, and documented anomalies from the Greco-Roman era is the Antikythera mechanism. Dating back to approximately 150 years BC, It stands as a computer out of time. It was discovered in a Roman shipwreck off the Greek island of Antikythera. This mechanism stunned modern scholars with its complexity, featuring more than 30 interlocking bronze gears and dials. The device calculated the positions of the sun, moon, planets, eclipses, and even Olympiad cycles. Researchers have noted that its design reflects Babylonian astronomical cycles, including the 27.3-day sidereal month and the 18-year Saros eclipse cycle. These alignments suggest access to Mesopotamian archives or surviving Sumerian knowledge dating back over a millennium prior to its construction. The fact that such a device appears suddenly, with no known prototypes or precedent designs, implies a rediscovery rather than an invention. Was the mechanism reverse-engineered from earlier pre-flood templates preserved by Babylonian scholars? The mechanism included a differential gear system, something that would not be reinvented until the late medieval clockmakers of 14th century Europe. That is an innovation time gap of almost 1,500 years before these sophisticated gearing techniques would be rediscovered or naturally innovated upon. So the Antikythera mechanism is almost a glitch in the matrix from the standards of our mainstream historical narratives. Think about this, it's like someone today inventing a mechanism and a technique and a technology 1,500 years ahead of this time. It's like someone inventing an iPhone 1,500 years ago. So it makes no sense unless we invoke lost knowledge, of which the Greeks had some fragments of, enough to rebuild some amazing technology from a bygone era, a pre-cataclysm era, suggesting the Antikythera mechanism was, in a sense, reverse-engineered from older examples of the technology or perhaps ancient schematics, building instructions, because we don't find any more of these mechanisms strewn across ancient Greece. It appears as an anomaly and could even be compared by today's standards to an exotic technology being created in a classified environment. You could invoke the current architecture of national security and classified research and apply it to the ancient Greek civilizations, because we know that they were sophisticated enough in their governmental and scholarly hierarchies to have incredible secret-keeping methods. And as there are other anomalies to highlight through the Greco-Roman empires, it would suggest that they absolutely had their version of what we could call classified programs and research endeavors, developing weapon systems, defensive countermeasures, as well as materials, composites, metallurgy, glasswork that was far beyond the time period and has failed to be repeated or replicated by later cultures and civilizations. Including, with some examples, our own modern-day scientific cultures, we still fail to replicate some of these historical anomalies, and especially when we attempt to replicate them with the tools that we, in my opinion, falsely attribute to the task and the time period, whether it be bone antler chisels or bronze hammers and copper nails, the models we give for what was possible at these times in relation to both knowledge and technology fails to explain these anomalies. It explains a lot of the cultures, the civilizations, the evidence of Bronze Age and Iron Age, it's not all lies. However, the anomalies that demand a different, more advanced level of knowledge and technique exist. And so other abilities must have been present at these times, not in wide deployment, in wide circulation for the masses, but just like in today's world, we know that the classified research communities have access to far more powerful tools and techniques and technologies than are given to the rest of us in the public. So it would seem clear that this is what we're also seeing in the ancient past, when extremely advanced artifacts that contradict the known capabilities of the time are discovered. We have to then recognize that some element, some aspect of these societies, of these civilizations, likely very niche groups, very protected and secretive organizations for churches and governments and academic bodies, had access to incredible, what would be seen at the time as beyond next generation capabilities, technologies, building techniques. And so where did they get that information from? Could it be that these massive empires that spanned across the globe, who looted and raided temples and sacred complexes and libraries all over the world, is it possible that they discovered secrets from a more ancient time, secrets from a lost time, civilizations that thrived long before Greece and Rome had even been conceptualized? Well, that is what the evidence is suggesting. Another incredible example of an anomaly in this time period, one that modern engineers continue to study with awe, is Roman concrete, especially its marine variant, which grows stronger over time. It has self-healing properties that are attributed to nanoparticles of specific materials. The concrete is composed of pozzolanic ash, lime, and seawater. This mixture reacts chemically to form aluminous tabemerite crystals, which are self-healing compounds that allow the concrete to repair micro cracks when exposed to water. This property eluded replication until MIT successfully engineered a synthetic version in 2023. So they couldn't replicate it through the processes and the materials used by the ancient Romans. They still had to use a synthetic group of materials in order to achieve this, which I would argue means that they have not successfully replicated the concrete. They have recreated the concrete with modern tools, but have failed to establish how the ancient Romans achieved this without the synthetic variants being used by MIT. So even in 2023, we could not recreate this ancient self-healing Roman concrete through their methods. We still had to fake it to make it. The Roman architect Vitruvius recorded the materials in De Architectura, but omitted the precise ratios and curing methods, which was likely done deliberately, as the precise formula was clearly a closely guarded secret of the upper echelons of Rome. The formula was lost following the collapse of the Western Roman Empire, coinciding with a systematic dismantling of pagan learning. Iconoclasm and theological suspicion towards empirical sciences likely drove the elites towards hiding such secrets or integrating them into religious symbolism, and in doing so, shielding them from total destruction as the world became more dogmatic and restrictive in its ideas. Another highly anomalous artifact that just cannot be explained with the tools and techniques that we attribute to ancient Rome is the Lycurgus cup. This 4th century CE dichroic glass cup, which is currently being housed in the British Museum, contains 70 nanometer gold and silver alloy particles, causing color shifts in red and green via surface plasmon resonance. So was this a case of accidental nanoparticle incorporation during glassmaking, or was it intentional colloidal chemistry? Because this cup and the technology and techniques presented within it predate modern nanotechnology by 1,600 years. So just like the Antikythera mechanism's differential gearing predated by 1,500 years, the same can be said with the nanoparticle gold-silver alloy technique that is deployed in this incredible cup that changes color when the light hits it and reflects from it from red to green, caused by these gold and silver embedded nanoparticles distributed in very specific sequences. So this is, again, an anomaly that is not supposed to exist, and yet it exists. So we have to ask the question, where did they get this knowledge from that apparently allowed them to do things that should not be possible for almost 1,500 to 2,000 years into the future? These are serious anomalies. These are serious gaps and problems in the model that mainstream archaeology and mainstream history tends to simply ignore. But you cannot ignore a mountain of evidence that is building higher and higher still, a mountain of anomalies. In the realms of military innovation and the use of advanced weapon systems, one such example stands out as an anomaly. It was employed by the Byzantine Navy during the defense of Constantinople, and it was known as Greek fire. Greek fire was a devastating incendiary weapon. It could burn atop the water and was reportedly immune to extinguishment by any conventional means. It was delivered via siphons or pressurized hoses, and the formula still remains unknown. Byzantine chronicler Procopius noted that the weapon was reverse-engineered from ancient Kladian scrolls captured during Mesopotamian campaigns under Justinian. These records may have described the use of volatile petrochemicals which appear in the Epic of Gilgamesh in reference to bitumen-lined boats and divine configurations. Whether purely chemical or partly mystical in its design, the weapon's origin story strongly indicates a reactivation of suppressed Mesopotamian knowledge systems in warfare. And you see a lot of this. It does harken back to the ancient Sumerian Mesopotamian empires. References continuously made to these far older civilizations providing the advanced technical knowledge through scrolls and tablets secured through campaigns and the overthrowing of nations and cultures in the Middle East. And so again, we have to ask, how was more advanced knowledge being derived from far older civilizations? Why does the historical development progression line run in reverse, getting more advanced as we go deeper into the past? Does this not heavily suggest a lost time period of advanced civilizations that were destroyed and fragments of advancement, fragments of that sophistication were saved and used, and then we see only fragments of anomalies popping up in ancient Greece, in ancient Rome? To me, it seems quite clear that this was information that had been secured from a time long before the current cycle of history. I believe this is more evidence to suggest that over 13,000 years ago, a highly advanced, globally influential civilization was thriving on this planet. The Great Library of Alexandria was a nexus of the old world. Alexander the Great's empire was as much a campaign of epistemological conquest as it was territorial. Upon defeating the Achaemenid Empire, Alexander's generals gained access to the libraries of Susa, Babylon, and Persepolis, where thousands of cuneiform tablets chronicled advanced systems of hydrology, astronomy, metallurgy, and medicine. Under the Ptolemies, the Library of Alexandria became the greatest synthesis hub of ancient information in the world. Egyptian high priests who guarded traditions from the pre-dynastic age were incentivized or coerced into sharing materials. These included writings from the House of the Phoenix, a temple complex said to preserve the teachings of Thoth, associated with Atlantean wisdom and antediluvian memory. Aristotle himself, a collector of foreign manuscripts, had his students transcribe forbidden alchemical texts that were later cited in medieval Arabic grimoires. Rome's militaristic campaigns often involved deliberate looting of intellectual capital. After the siege of Syracuse in 212 BC, the Roman general Marcellus seized not just spoils, but Archimedes' secret engineering manuscripts, rumored to include heat ray designs and advanced hydraulics. These were locked away for senatorial eyes only, once again mirroring the modern examples we have today of classified research, special access programs. The same thing was happening in the ancient past. Similarly, during the 70 CE destruction of the Second Temple of Jerusalem, Roman forces under Titus confiscated sacred scrolls and archives, and some accounts suggest that they were hidden in the tabularium, accessible only to the Flavian elite. This act may have constituted one of the largest single seizures of pre-monotheistic mystical knowledge in history. Seneca the Younger alluded to such secrets in Naturalis Questionis, where he cryptically claimed that celestial arts are the inheritance of noble bloodlines. While Julius Caesar's siege in 48 BC did destroy a portion of the Great Library of Alexandria, subsequent purges were far more deliberate. The Theodosian decrees in 391 CE, which banned pagan worship, culminated in the razing of the Serapeum, the library's philosophical annex. Bishop Theophilus of Alexandria oversaw the destruction of what many claim to be a repository of pre-Adamite civilization records, including scrolls tracing human history back hundreds of thousands of years. This eradication was more than religious, it was epistemological warfare. Following Constantine's adoption of Christianity, early church fathers such as Augustine redefined ancient esoteric sciences as demonic distortions. In De Civitate Dei, Augustine denounced the Nephilim, the sons of God from Genesis 6, as deceivers teaching fallen knowledge. At the Council of Nicaea, 325 CE, texts like Berossus's Biblionica were suppressed due to their descriptions of pre-flood kings ruling for 432,000 years, a time frame aligning with Sumerian king lists and Hindu Yuga cycles. This kind of suppression reveals a consistent pattern: ancient texts that challenge biblical chronology or offer technological marvels are rendered apocryphal or heretical. Which brings us to the modern day, where this issue persists and the secreting away of incredibly important historical information and artifacts is represented in no grander and more disturbing form than the Vatican Church and its apostolic archives, a veritable fortress of forbidden knowledge. Founded in 1612, the Vatican Apostolic Archives is home to over 53 miles worth of shelving, in order to hold all of the knowledge that the Holy See has sequestered away over the centuries, and is not available in its full form to the public. It is not even available in its full form to scholars. You need to be a specific scholar within a specific discipline, and then you can make a specific request for a specific piece of information. You may be provided that information, but you are not provided anything outside of your requests. This is how the intelligence community operates with classified programs, silos and stovepipes, compartmented intelligence, special access programs. This is the same behavior being exhibited by the Vatican in relation to our own history. The Index Librorum Prohibitorum, which is Latin for List of Prohibited Books, was a powerful tool of ecclesiastical censorship used by the Catholic Church to suppress writings it deemed heretical, blasphemous, immoral, or otherwise dangerous to the faith and the authority of the Church. It was first issued in 1559, and it was updated regularly all the way up until its abolishment in 1966, by which point, of course, the damage to the expansion of knowledge for the masses had very much been done already. And this suppression of knowledge is almost always done, especially when it is done by the Church, to benefit you, to help you, to assist you on your spiritual journey, to protect you from heresy. But one man's heresy is another man's destiny. The mysticism, the occultism, the esoterica, the scientific ideas, the philosophical ideas, all branded as demonic or evil, heretical. This is a direct sabotage on human ingenuity, on creativity, on our natural abilities, our origins, our birthright, our future. And that is why we must revisit the past, because our knowledge, or lack thereof, could have significant consequences for where humanity goes in the future. For quite a few years now, I've been looking at archaeology, archaeoastronomy, quantum physics, acoustics, mythology, and consciousness studies, and exploring the possibility that a highly advanced civilization once existed on Earth, long before the historical records that we currently hold as gospel. A civilization predating the Younger Dryas period, before the global cataclysm around 12,800 years ago. We see astonishing precision in ancient megalithic sites all over the world, whether it's the polygonal cyclopean walls of Sacsayhuaman in Peru, the acoustic chambers of the Hypogeum in Malta, the incredible and contradictory sophistication of the Osirian in Egypt, or the stone-forged acoustics that are encoded into the architecture of Shavintahuanta. These sites were not built by primitive people. The level of geometric exactitude, celestial alignment, vibration-sensitive engineering, all demonstrates an awareness of Earth's subtle energetic anatomy, what we might now call planetary bioelectromagnetism. And so, as controversial as it may be to some of the official halls of mainstream archaeology and history, I believe, alongside many others, that these ancient builders had access to knowledge that modern science is only now rediscovering through fields like quantum biology, cymatics, and consciousness research. It would seem that stone wasn't just structural for these people. It was functional. It was chosen for its piezoelectric, paramagnetic, or diamagnetic properties, either being attracted to or repelled by magnetic fields, and being able to produce electricity through mechanical stress. And some sites, including one that I recently visited on the island of Malta, I believe acted as a form of consciousness amplifier, literally interfacing with human biofields through sound and harmonic resonance. the ancients were engaging in something that's called psychoacoustic architecture, constructing sonic temples, acoustic chambers that could induce altered states or expand awareness. And when we look at the global mythologies, we see this mirrored in the stories, beings of great stature, advanced knowledge, and spiritual insights arriving after floods or falling from the sky, teaching humanity how to build, how to farm, how to govern, and even how to connect with the divine. And I think we are often far too quick in the Western world of academia to arrogantly dismiss these myths and legends of cultural and civilizational origins as mere archetypes, as metaphors. Anything other than a literal interpretation of the events experienced and subsequently documented. And yet we don't just have the stories. We have the extremely advanced evidence left behind. We have the shattered remains of incredible temples and structures that defy our conventional models. And so why do we so quickly dismiss the indigenous histories when they are also backed up by architectural anomalies that we cannot explain? So when you really look at it, you begin to realize that, well, really, despite the loudness of the voice and the self-proclaimed righteousness of those in the mainline theory arena of history, despite how wise and academically literate they appear to be, they are actually ignoring massive amounts of very clear evidence that strengthens the myths, and they still side with the narrative that is weakest, simply because it has been held onto for the longest. Now, this is not a sign of a free thinker. You have to be relatively indoctrinated at this point to continue calling the rest of us conspiracy theorists, simply because we are examining the wider pool of evidence, connecting the dots, and finding serious problems, discrepancies with the current narratives of human history. The myth of the flood, the Great Flood, is almost universal. Cultures from the Americas to Mesopotamia to the Pacific Islands all speak of a global deluge, a moment when an older world was wiped clean. And we find remarkably consistent accounts globally of a cataclysmic flood, often accompanied by cosmic or seismic upheavals, and are always followed by a rebuilding of civilization, often with external guidance from powerful figures who emerge and bring to the people their civilization-building knowledge. These are not isolated stories. They are a global pattern, stretching from the Andes to the Himalayas, from tribal oral traditions to ancient epics that are etched in stone. For example, one of the earliest known flood myths written down comes from Mesopotamia, which we now know as the region of Iraq and Syria. The Epic of Gilgamesh, where the Sumerian god Enlil sends a flood to destroy mankind. And within this epic, you then have Atrahasis, who is a Noah-type figure, who is instructed to build a boat and save animals and humans. The text also mentions multiple prior civilizations that were wiped out by floods and other catastrophes, which implies a cycle of destruction and rebirth that has played out across the eons, which is another claim that is echoed across ancient cultures worldwide. Then you have the Satya Yuga flood myths from the Vedic texts of ancient India. In the Shatapatha Brahmana, it tells of a great flood, foretold to a figure named Manu, who is warned by a deity called Vishnu or Matsya. Manu builds a boat to rescue the sages and the sacred knowledge from the coming destruction, and then after the flood, Manu is told to rebuild the world, with guidance from beings who are associated with maintaining the cosmic order. We have stories from the Aztec and the Mayan traditions of ancient Mesoamerica. The Aztec codices describe several previous suns or ages of man, each destroyed by a different catastrophe, one of which was a massive flood. The Popol Vuh, which is a sacred Mayan text, recounts how humanity was recreated multiple times after great floods and fire from the sky. Each cycle ended in destruction, but between these cycles, spiritual deities and teachers would emerge and re-educate humanity in the ways of agriculture, astronomy, timekeeping, all of the necessary elements needed to bring humanity back from the brink. In ancient Greek mythology, Zeus floods the earth to punish humanity. Polynesian cultures speak of a great wave and rising seas that drowned the ancient lands. Why we discount so many instances of the same story across culture is nonsensical. What interests me the most is what preceded the floods. What was before all of this destruction? Well, the Sumerian and Egyptian accounts speak of the antediluvian kings who ruled for thousands of years, figures of immense wisdom, of cosmic knowledge, builders of vast stone structures. In Egyptian records, like those kept by the priest Manetho, he speaks of the time of the Shemsu Hor, the time of the followers of Horus, who he says predated the dynastic pharaohs and was said to have built great works of stone. Then, of course, you have Göbekli Tepe in Turkey, the oldest megalithic site in the world, and one that mainstream archaeology would have us believe to be the start of civilization. But it seems more like the restarting of civilization to me. With evidence of organized labor and advanced astronomical knowledge suddenly popping up seemingly out of nowhere, there is no evidence of a gradual progression up towards a site like Göbekli Tepe. It just appears in an area associated typically with hunter-gatherer communities. So the idea that these hunter-gatherers put down their spears one day, climbed out of their deer-hide tents and began constructing multi-ton stone building projects with precision cosmic and geodetic alignment, crafting with precision some of the hardest stones on the planet, during a period of time that, according to our completely broken and inept models for history, predates the use of even copper and bronze tools, predates the invention of the wheel, and predates essentially all markers of civilizational development. The Stone Age, the Neolithic Age, an age where we are taught we are a rudimentary, basic, primal people. A very basic form of humanity. Suddenly out of nowhere during this time period, we start making Stonehenge, Göbekli Tepe, Newgrange, the Hypogeum. It makes absolutely no sense. What we see are global cultural parallels across disconnected civilizations. We see the reoccurring elements of stair-stepped pyramids and ziggurats. We see alignments to solstices and equinoxes. We see sacred geometry encoded into the architecture. We see the use of incredibly hard and also incredibly energetic stone building materials like granite, quartzite, diorite, and basalt. And we see a clear display of sound and vibrational knowledge, a science of sound and of acoustical engineering being deployed in many of these building projects. And that is something we're only just beginning to realize on the bleeding edge of modern neuroscience and biophysics. Has an incredible impact on human beings' states of consciousness, their brainwave state. Human consciousness, human perception can be changed through precise acoustic bombardment from the correct Hertz ranges. The same Hertz ranges that we continuously find acoustically engineered to be propagated through these ancient prehistoric sites. All of this points to something very profound. The flood myths may have been humanity's deep memory of a very real global cataclysm. And the civilization that came before it may not have been primitive, but exceptionally advanced in ways that we're just beginning to understand. They may have built with the Earth, not against it, using vibrational principles, geo-alignment, consciousness-enhancing architecture, energy systems based on natural harmonics. Stone, especially when it contains quartz or magnetite, has the capacity to store and emit electromagnetic information. And what I'm really beginning to suspect is that some of these ancient sites were built as resonant consciousness amplifiers, leveraging standing wave phenomena, magnetic fields, and harmonic geometry to engage in altered states of mind. Temples that weren't for worship necessarily, but for a form of activation, transformation, transcendence. Even within the myths, we see echoes of this idea. The Ark of the Covenant was said to be a resonating device. The Buddhists' stupas were aligned not for beauty or aesthetics, but to create a spiritual frequency. And the pyramids of Egypt, with their mysterious acoustic properties, may have actually been tools for transformation. They certainly were not tombs for the pharaohs. This proposition has quite literally zero evidence behind it, and yet it is the predominant theory. Another example of laziness masquerading as academic rationality. The tombs and pyramids and dolmens and obelisks and henges of the world are not given the credit they deserve, are not given the credit they objectively demonstrate through their advanced nature, for their multidisciplinary evidence that is encoded into the stone, into the geometry, into the alignments, into the very materials used, and then of course the size of the projects, the sheer scale. Huge stones being quarried and sometimes transported literally hundreds of miles, even over bodies of water. This is not the work of simple people. This is not the work of hunter-gatherers. And to insinuate this as a possibility is, in my opinion, an insult to our ancestors. There is increasing evidence that consciousness interacts with the quantum fields of information. The bleeding-edge theories in emerging arenas, such as quantum biophysics, would posit that the human brain-body mechanism is more of a complex receiver than a complex generator of consciousness, that we are, in fact, suspended in an ocean of energetic flux that has embedded within it, down to the smallest element, down to the very Planck scale, and potentially beyond it, an ambient awareness, an underlying coherence, and that we, human beings, are antennas, sophisticated antennas, ones that can be tuned and modulated, even through our own conscious will, via meditation and other such methods, that we can calibrate our minds, our perceptions, to more expansive levels of experience, allowing the gates of default perception to burst open and flood the human interface with information condensed from higher dimensions, varying layers of reality that we are not normally perceptive to. I believe there was a chapter of Earth's history where these realizations were not only being made, but they were being enhanced through the very architecture that these civilizations were creating. Temples for transforming rather than subjugation, connection to the primal energies of creation rather than adherence to an intermediary. Our rigid structure of theology with our priestly classes and our hierarchies towards the heavens are, in my opinion, a blasphemy to the true nature of the Creator, which is of unbounded freedom and total unrestricted love. Something that you feel when you connect with the deepest aspects of your own consciousness and realize that you have an entire universe within you. And perhaps our most ancient ancestors, who worked so tirelessly in these stone building projects, had an understanding of this that we have yet to grasp. Some of the skeptical responses to a lot of these issues are statements such as, there's no evidence ancient people had advanced technology. But this depends on your definition of advanced. I mean, if you're talking about iPhones and microchips, okay, of course not, no. But if you mean knowledge of resonant frequency engineering, piezoelectric materials, and celestial geodetic alignments accurate to within fractions of a degree, then yes, the evidence is overwhelming. Precision-cut granite in Egypt and Peru, interlocking megaliths with no mortar and no movement over thousands of years. Temples tuned to acoustic harmonics. These are advanced forms of analog, field-based technology that modern engineers are only just starting to understand in experimental labs. When engineers like Christopher Dunn tested the tolerances in places like the Serapeum and Giza, they found cuts smoother and more precise than what we achieve with modern diamond saws. So the real question is, how did primitive people outperform us in stonework? That's what I would put forward to the skeptical question. Skeptics also claim that mythologies aren't historical, they're just stories. Sure, myths are symbolic, but symbols often encode truth, especially when the same themes appear worldwide in disconnected cultures. Take the global flood myth, for example. Over 200 cultures have one. Or the recurring figure of a civilizer god like Viracocha or Quetzalcoatl or Oannes, who come after catastrophe to teach lost knowledge. These aren't isolated coincidences, they are patterns. If we saw this kind of thematic mirroring in biology or linguistics, we would call it a shared ancestry. But when it happens in myth, we dismiss it as imagination. Now that is called selective logic. I'm not saying take the stories literally. I'm just saying take them more seriously. People often accuse alternative historians and theorists as connecting dots that aren't really there. Well, pattern recognition is the foundation of science. The entire field of archaeology is based on interpreting fragments of data into a coherent picture. When we see similar architectural styles, when we see mathematical systems, when we see cosmic orientations in ancient sites across continents before those cultures had contact, we should be curious, not dismissive. Sure, connecting dots can lead to wild theories, but refusing to connect them at all leads to intellectual stagnation. My question is, what level of correlation would it take for you to consider that we've overlooked a global inheritance of ancient knowledge? And when it comes to these more, I guess you could say, far out there ideas about these ancient people utilizing these stone building projects and these geometries and these acoustic sciences for influencing consciousness, so many people will still dismiss this. Consciousness can't interact with matter. That's woo-woo, magical, you know, spiritual, new age nonsense. That view is already outdated. Quantum biology has shown that quantum effects occur in biological systems, including bird navigation, plant photosynthesis, and possibly even human cognition. Theories like the orchestrated objective reduction theory, ORC-OR, by Sir Roger Penrose and Stuart Hameroff, propose that consciousness arises not from neurons alone, but from quantum processes inside microtubules, which are structures inside the cells of neurons. This is peer-reviewed, this is ongoing research, and it is not fringe. If consciousness interacts with quantum fields and materials like quartz can store and transmit electromagnetic information, then ancient structures using these materials aligned to geomagnetic nodes may very well have acted as forms of consciousness amplifiers. That's not pseudoscience, that's frontier science, and there is a difference. Because if mainstream history is so complete, why are we still uncovering massive sites like Göbekli Tepe that push back the timeline of civilization by thousands of years? We were told for over a century that nothing advanced existed before 3000 BC. Now we're finding complex megalithic temples in Turkey dated to 9600 BC. So how many more paradigm-shifting sites are still buried, both literally and institutionally? It seems to me that we're in a time of absolutely fundamental change and transition and turbulence. The status quo, the models, the patterns and the ideas that have become so rigid over time are beginning to break away, not just in history, society in general, geopolitics, physics. Everything is changing. And like Graham Hancock said, everything just seems to be getting older and older and older. How far back does human history truly go? Well, I would hasten to say that it goes back a lot further than we're currently being allowed to believe in.